This is 12:25 p.m., July 8, 1962. This is Earl Neff and Bob Grove in the backyard of their home in Strongsville, Ohio.
Bob, I think it'd be interesting to tell the audience the type of work you do.
Well, I'm a school teacher. I teach physics, physical science, and space science, which is a sort of a composite of electronics as well as the new founded space science over at Root High School in North Royalton.
Recently, I understand you took a trip to Canada. Interview Robert Smith.
That's right. It was one of two main purposes, one of which was actually a honeymoon. My wife and I, who at that time had been married 4 months, this was, as you know, 2 weeks ago, and we thought it was about time we had a honeymoon.
Did you you did to get to interview Robert Smith in spite of his illness?
Yes, despite his illness, we had, I feel, a very successful interview with him. It amounted to two meetings of a couple hours each. As a result of this, I feel that I came back rich with information. I won't say that all of the information necessarily do I agree with, nor really would I condemn any of it. The information is all founded, I feel, on a very sincere, dedicated, and intelligent reasoning process on the part of Mr. Smith, and this is, of course, the primary purpose of our recording is to go over some of this material.
Yes. I think it might be well if you would mention here just who Wilbur Smith is for the benefit of anyone who might be in doubt.
All right. Wilbur B. Smith was director of the project which we referred to in the early 50s as Project Magnet, which of course was Canada's introduction to governmental pursuits of UFO phenomena. Wilbur Smith being a member of the Transportation Board of Canada, which is very similar to our Federal Communications Commission and other means of both communication and transportation, and the Canadian Board. They have actually a combined effort in these parts.
I remember reading a number of articles of his in Flying Fox Review of London some years ago, being the home of George Popovich, the director of the Arts and UFO Research Committee. I also recall reading quite a long letter by Robert Smith. It was very, very interesting to me. He referred at that time in that letter, as I recall, about the hardware that he felt that we had in this country. You arrived in, this is Ottawa where he lives?
That's right. He actually lives in City View, which is a residential suburb to the southwest of the city of Ottawa, just outside of the capital city by perhaps two or three miles.
He was sufficiently well to be interviewed, I understand.
He had just returned from the hospital. He was well enough for discussion and occasional movement on of his own volition. He accompanied us from the outside in, and then again when we left, he accompanied us to the door. But from the standpoint of being really in good physical condition, as of yet, he was not.
I presume you had quite a few questions in your own mind that you would like answered.
Yes, indeed.
Supposing that you just pick it up from there now for a little while, I'll keep interrupting your time.
All right.
If you don't mind.
No, because you have questions, of course, which I will fail to foresee, and if anything does pop up, why, you be sure to ask.
Wonderful.
From the time we met immediately, I hope I didn't bug him with these questions, but I did go on with quite a number of them to find out what his ideas were. I should say at first, as we go into this, that the opinions, the theories, and the statements which I will make from here on into the recording will be those of Wilbur Smith. They are not necessarily those of my own. First of all, it might be well to note that Mr. Smith's ideas of what we call dimensions of reality are in the number of 12. He believes that there are 12 dimensions, which he calls parameters, and they are in sets of three each. That is, four fields, he calls them, or fabrics, perhaps I should say fabrics, to which he referred. The first three we call the space fabric, and this is the one, of course, with which we're all familiar. The distance between two points we call length. As we move this length back and forth, we occupy an area, which is the second space fabric. And finally, as the area itself moves back and forth in the third plane, we make volume. Now, we go into what we commonly refer to as the fourth dimension, which is time. This, then, we have left now the first three space fabric, and we now enter what we call the field fabric. Time being the fourth parameter, we call this the tempic field. This, according to Mr. Smith, is derived actually from volume, and each one of these, by the way, can be derived from the preceding. The tempic field then is derived from volume. The fifth would be derived by going through the fourth, and so on right down through all 12 of these parameters. The tempic field then, number four, this is derived from volume through the application of the quadrature concept, something I'm unfortunately unable to discuss at this time. Not because of not being willing to, only because of lack of ability to. Number five, we have the electric field. Six, the magnetic field. Now these complete the field fabric. Seven, eight, and nine are what we call the control fabric, or I should say more correctly, what he calls the control fabric. Seventh is what he calls random and chaos disorganization. Eighth is the idea of the entering of free will or choice. And ninth, we finally have sequence or orderliness. Now these are what he calls control fabric. The final three parameters, number 10, form, number 11, particularization, and 12, aggregation. Now we have completed by these length, area, volume, those again the first three parameters comprising the space fabric, the tempic field, electric field, and magnetic field. Those are 4, 5, and 6, comprising the field fabric. 7th, 8th, and 9th were of the control fabric. These were random, chaos, disorganization, free will and choice, sequence and orderliness. Finally, the precipitation, from the word perceived, the precipitation fabric. 10th was form, 11th particularization, and 12th aggregation. So these were what he calls the 12 dimensions. He says that all of these concepts and measurements which we have in reality start at zero and extend to infinity, so that any of these 12 can actually be measured concretely, and they begin at zero or non-existence and extend to infinity without any finite limit. Any parameter, again, can be reached as a natural consequence of the extension of the previous expression, so that we could get number 5, for example, the electric field, by extending the time or tempic field, which was 4, and then if we wanted from volume going through, which was 3, going through 4, and then to 5, you see, so that any one of these can be reached by going through the other fabrics. All right, this is the idea then of the 12 dimensions or parameters. Going on from there, let me handle first his idea of gravity, what gravity is, natural as well as artificial. Gravity can be expressed as a formula, as an equation, actually, as the product of first the square of the quantity polarization. And polarization is expressed as, for example, volts times centimeters, or volt centimeters. This would be one way of saying polarization. We take this quantity after squaring it and multiply it times field divergence, which is a reciprocal quantity. It's 1 over the radius of whatever field we are discussing. So that as a formula, we would have gravity equals polarization squared times the field divergence. Or another way to express that would be gravity equals volt centimeters, the quantity squared, times 1 over the radius. This would be a means then of actually providing us with a formula from which to work. Now we get into artificial gravity. How can we actually produce this? Well, we know a formula. We've just discussed that. So let's do some dealings then with the actual operation of this formula and apply it. In doing this, I have a disk here, which we'll have to describe, I think, to the audience, Earl. As you can see, it's a disk approximately 5 inches in diameter. Perhaps I should say that its construction is a ring of brass in which we have placed several ceramic magnets in a concentric pattern around the center.
I see eight there.
Yes, that's right. There are eight of the little square ceramic magnets. Now, this has then been filled in order to keep these in order. We have filled this ring and covered the magnets with a polyester material, actually a type of liquid plastic, which has a curing agent. When we mix these two together, why, it sets very hard. You can see it has a yellowish tint, and it's a very poor job from the standpoint of what I've been able to do with it.
You mix that catalyst with it yourself?
That's right. These both come from one of the large chemical distributors in two cans, and then upon mixing, we cure one, and then it begins to set.
Yeah.
We have then a concentric configuration of eight ceramic magnets. These are flat little ceramic magnets, as you can see, having two broad surfaces. The surfaces, by the way, are the ones that are polarized north and south, not the ends or the edges, but the surfaces. So the large surfaces on top are all north, and on the bottom, all south. So that when we have these in this concentric configuration, why, we have only north pole on one side and only south pole on the other side, making the whole ring itself polarized one side or the other, north and south.
This is a brass ring on
this
the outside that has
ring,
no magnetic.
Right. None whatsoever. The only magnetism is inherent in the ceramic magnet.
Oh, yes.
Now, according to Mr. Smith, an artificial gravity can be produced by this device by finding its perfect center, balancing it well, and spinning it. Now, it's not a question of just putting it on a pencil after drilling a hole and whirling it around. This has to be spun at a very high, very appreciable rate of spin. His experimental model, he was able to get up to 15,000 revolutions per minute. Now, to do this, he took the disc, mounted it on a shaft, actually a non-magnetic permeable shaft, so that it would have no magnetic effect. This shaft then went down to a motor. It was a series wound motor, so that we could get up tremendous speeds with this low load on it. The motor he used was a vacuum cleaner motor, the field coil of which was fed by a rheostat, which had been connected in series with the line voltage. Line voltage he used was 220 volts. Now, of course, the 110 volt vacuum cleaner motor on a 220 volt line would really spin, and this was the idea. He did achieve 15,000 revolutions per minute with this. Now he had done this. By the way, the first results, unfortunately, were quite a calamity. The thing blew up like a hand grenade because of the tremendous velocity it was reached, its spinning velocity. So, of course, some measure had to be taken in order to protect the observers, the experimenters, which was done. They built a well out of concrete block, and then the entire unit was placed in this well. And this worked quite well. The well worked well. On spinning it then, they found they had one that apparently wasn't going to blow up, this next one, and it would be a good idea now to try some rather positive steps in experimental work. The ones that they used, there were two. First, they took a wristwatch. Now, the reason they did this, remember originally in our 12 parameters, we discussed the possibility that time was one of the parameters. In fact, we call it the fourth dimension. As we go through others, we get into electric field and the magnetic and so on, which possibly has something to do, you see, with gravity. And this was the experiment to see whether there was a relationship. Well, now, obviously, if these are all interrelated and we warp one of them, creating, for example, an artificial gravity, then perhaps there'd be a noticeable effect in one of the other parameters that we could observe. So what they did, they took a wristwatch. I would presume, although I don't know, I would presume it was an anti-magnetic watch. And this was then placed in the field, the magnetic field of the disc, which was then spun. Now, upon spinning this at 15,000 RPM with the watch in close proximity to it, this was done for a period, actually, of 5 minutes. And at the end of this 5-minute interval, the watch was again removed and checked, and it had lost 20 seconds. So very definitely, the watch had lost 20 seconds, a perfectly well-running watch, I might add, in this five-minute interval of the field being placed in proximity to it. Now, of course, one might immediately say, well, if it were a magnetically susceptible watch, perhaps the magnetism itself had something to do with this. Well, this is quite true, and this is the reason, of course, why it should have definite experimental work before one can come to any particular conclusions about it. However, I would definitely assure myself that Mr. Smith probably knows when a watch is magnetic or non-magnetic, and that he would not use a magnetic watch in a magnetic field. This, of course, would be absurd. And I feel quite confident that he did take this precaution. The next experiment that was used, I will have to delve a little bit into electronic theory on this one. I hope I can, as a radio ham, I hope I'll be able to do some justice to this. We find that if we take a coil of wire and we put across it a device called a capacitor, that this will have a distinct sensitivity to a particular radio frequency. That is, a certain number of prescribed turns with a certain type of capacitor across it will have what we call a resonance to a certain radio frequency. Now, we find that he did this, by he, of course, I mean Mr. Smith. He took a coil of wire and put a capacitor across it, and he shielded it well so that no extraneous effects around it would change the resonant frequency of this. And this is what we call actually an LC oscillator. The L stands for, oddly enough, inductance, which is the coil, and the C stands for capacitance. That is the capacitor that's placed across it to determine the frequency. And this coil, this probe, I should say, and consisting of a capacitor and a coil, were fed through a shielded piece of coaxial cable, and the device itself was shielded, into an oscillator. This oscillator then, of course, this circuit, would be the frequency in, of which it would oscillate was, of course, contingent upon the configuration of that coil and the capacitor. Now, they had a very distinct frequency. They monitored it on a receiver. They heard it on the receiver. They put a beat frequency oscillator on the receiver, which is a device that provides a frequency very close to the one that original coil and capacitor were resonant to. Now, when we get two frequencies right together, we get what we call a beat note. That is a resultant frequency as a result of the two playing against each other. Now, this is an audible note. The LC oscillator probe, then, was put into this revolving field, and upon doing so, as soon as it was put in, the there was a distinct change in the note, a very distinct, I mean a tremendous change in the beat note. Now, this meant, without any question, the only thing that could possibly have changed was the time that was involved, because the mechanics of the coil was still there. The capacitor was still the same type. You might say, well, if this is spinning, perhaps we're going to get, if it's a magnet and it's spinning, perhaps we're going to get a voltage buildup that's going to have some effect. However, might I remind you that the only way that you can induce voltage into a coil with a magnet spinning is if the magnet is spinning end over end, so we get north, south, like that. And this, remember, isn't. The axis of the magnetic field is spinning, so that we always have exactly the same amount of north or exactly the same amount of south all the time it's spinning. So this definitely would not come into play here at all. Again, then, when he placed this LC oscillator coil into the field that was being set up by this spinning disc, we notice a very distinct shift in frequency of that coil, without any question. So these were two experiments that were done, and both noticeably had effect by being placed in the field. The next theory of Mr. Smith's, which I shall endeavor to discuss, is that of a fascinating, I find it one of the most fascinating of all, and this is tensor energy. Tensor energy. Mr. Smith refers to tensor energy actually as a polydimensional vector. That is, it's a definite vector quantity. It can be measured. It's going somewhere, we can say, and it can be measured. It's polydimensional, however. That is, there are various aspects of dimension to it. Normally, we think of energy as measured in orthodox X, Y, and Z axes, or that possibly in arithmetic expressions L, M, and N. These are different types of measuring, of course, dimensions. Tensor energy is what Mr. Smith refers to a six-dimensional space wave. Not six, but six dimensions, actually. Six-dimensional space wave. It has no velocity. All points, then, would be at interval zero. That is, if it has no velocity, you see, we don't have to think of point-to-point crests on it as a space wave. You see, we don't have to think of these points as having certain time intervals, because there is none. It has interval zero. It's not under any particular velocity. It has, then, freedom from both space and time. Both space and time. Now, to wind a coil, which will be able to actually transfer electrical, or we might say electromagnetic, that is high frequency, radio frequency energy, into tensor energy. I have a device here which is wound as per Mr. Smith's instructions. Now what we do, we start out with a piece of ferrite core. Now ferrite, of course, is the ferric oxide material in a clay matrix, which is used as the antennae, are used as antennae in the backs of the little transistor radios, and even the transoceanic shortwave radios and so on use these. They're a core, partially magnetically permeable, but for the most part they're almost just like a hard clay, or they look really like slate, but they do have, it's artificially man-made, and it is a clay matrix with ferric oxide in it, so it is partially magnetic. Now, we take this, and the diameter of this rod has to be 1/8 of the length, 1/7 to 1/8, right in there. This is fairly critical, but not terribly critical. The one I have here, of course, is approximately, I would say, 3/8 diameter. Unfortunately, this isn't good enough. Mr. Smith used for his one was an inch in diameter and 8 inches long. This, of course, is a very large piece of ferrite core, not the type that one might be able to find in a radio stock at your local radio wholesale distributor, as I well know. This summer I am working for a local wholesale radio house, and unfortunately I've been unable to get any as of yet after several weeks of trying, but some of the coil companies probably do stock this material, and I have ordered it. Now, the coil is wound in a very weird fashion, actually. We start with a long hunk of insulated wire, perhaps number 22, 24, 26, cotton covered, so that we have it insulated. And then we take the very long length of it, probably if we have one, for example, an inch in diameter and 8 inches long, naturally we'd have to use probably 20 or 30, maybe even 40 feet of wire by the time we're through winding, to wind it over the entire surface. We start then by taking the wire, the one length, and doubling it over so that we have two free ends, and then at the opposite, of course, we have the loop where it turns over and comes back again. Now we take the ferrite core and we start at that loop. In other words, we've taken this double-backed wire and pull it over the one end of the ferrite core so that we're up snug against it. We have two leads now, each equal in length, going back from the core, and then we start winding, each lead going in the opposite direction around this ferrite core. In doing this, as we come around and the two leads meet for the first time on the halfway around this ferrite core, we cross them over. Let's say we cross the right one over the left one. Now, on that side, every time these leads again come around, we have to do it exactly the same way, and I mean exactly symmetrical, without any variation detectable. So that when we're through now, we will have then on this one side, as the leads come around, right going over left. Then these leads, of course, pass around and get back to the original side again, and we go left over right. You see, just the opposite. Now we repeat this all the way down the coil, starting out with the loop first coming around halfway around the coil, and we put right over left. Then we pull these around to the other side, and left goes over right. And then all the way down like this. They're tight wound against each other, tight wound against the core. And when we're through and we look at this, we'll see that on one side of the rod, they're all right over left. On the other side of the rod, all left over right. so that this goes all the way, the entire length of the coil, and finally down at the bottom of the coil when we finish, we simply lightly twist these and pull away a lead with which we can work as an actual lead. Now, as I mentioned, this coil has to be completely symmetrical. If there's any variations whatsoever, according to Mr. Smith, it will not work. As a matter of fact, Mr. Smith has wound several of these. Not all of them work. And some of them would work only after rewinding the same core with the same wire in what appeared to be the same fashion, but probably just approaching a better symmetry. Upon completion of this, we try to find what the resonant frequencies are of this coil. Now, I say R. This seems strange. I said before that a coil of wire, of course, with a given capacitor across it, will have a one particular resonant frequency. However, this coil, by the very configuration of its winding, has a large number of resonant frequencies and what we call harmonics. Now, we take this coil and we use an instrument called a grid dip oscillator. A GDO, or grid dip oscillator, is a device very commonly used by hams as well as technicians to find out what frequencies we're dealing with after we've wound a coil. Is it wound to the frequency for which we intend to use it? I'm taking this grid dip oscillator then. We will put the coil of the grid dip oscillator next to this tensor energy converter coil, and we'll start swinging the control on there and read directly from this grid dip oscillator exactly what frequencies this thing seems to be sensitive to. There's a little meter, and this little meter on the grid dip oscillator, that is, the instrument with which we are checking this tensor energy converter coil, the little meter will dip. That's where we get the name, the dip part of the grid dip oscillator. The meter itself will swing downward when we go across the frequency to which this is sensitive or resonant. And then we read on the calibration on the meter exactly what the frequency is to which this is particularly resonant. I've done that with this small coil I built, and I found, for example, this has a resonant frequency of 3.64 megacycles, 8.1 megacycles, 18.2 megacycles, 43 megacycles, and just above 250 megacycles. So that obviously then, even this small one with larger wire than should be on here has a large number, in fact, five that I checked, and perhaps even more that I didn't check, frequencies to which this is sensitive. Now, the application of this coil, how do we actually determine whether this coil is going to be doing something weird? In fact, what is it supposed to do? Well, we take the coil, we remember what frequencies we've had, and we put it on a transmitter. Now, let's deal for a moment with the outcome of the experiment done by Mr. Smith with his own coil. I think this is better, inasmuch as I haven't put this coil that I have just wound on a transmitter yet. Mr. Smith had a coil which was resonant on his, for example, between 2 and 20 megacycles, there were 12 resonant points. And he found that on taking this, that one of the resonant points was very close to 4 megacycles. Very close to 4 megacycles. So, they took a Collins KW1, which is a 1,000-watt amateur transmitter, tuned it up to 4 megacycles, and fed the output of this high-powered transmitter into his tensor energy converter coil, which was number 14 copper wire, which had been wound on a 1-inch ferrite core, again 8 inches long. So the Collins KW1 then was set on master oscillator, which is VFO, or variable frequency, so that it could be changed instead of being crystal controlled, and then they'd have to see whatever crystals they had to determine the frequency they were going to transmit into this coil. They set it at 4 megacycles. The coil itself, the tensor energy converter coil, was mounted in a copper box. Now, they thought by mounting it in a copper box, this would shield it from re-radiating any energy that went into it. So that what he was thinking, if this transmitter was putting out a tremendous amount of electromagnetic energy, and this tensor energy coil were not only accepting it, but converting it into something, then, of course, the coil itself would possibly get hot if it were absorbing this and re-radiating it. Now, if we put a shield around it, it can't re-radiate it into space. This energy that's being transferred into here will be actually shielded from being re-radiated. So we put the copper shield around it and fed it with this 1,000 watts of radio frequency energy at its 4 megacycle resonant point. According to Mr. Smith, as we take the transmitter and change its frequency so that we cover all the frequencies to which this tensor energy converter coil is actually resonant, or as many as possible, we'll find at least one frequency which seems to actually accept infinite power without ever heating to any appreciable degree. So that here we have a coil of wire which should heat by all rights if a lot of power is being fed to it. But according to Mr. Smith, we actually have a coil in this tensor energy that will accept all radio frequency power that can even be put to it. And it will not re-radiate it. It does not store it up. It's going somewhere, but where? Well, according to Mr. Smith, this material into which the radio frequency energy is being changed is tensor energy. Now, tensor energy being having no particular velocity, no particular time intervals involved, you see, because, of course, as he mentions, there's no time intervals in between the crests of the wave, although it is a definitely a wave form. It doesn't have to go anywhere and be radiated at the speed of light or anything like this. So it actually apparently can just store up. And according to him, it in fact does this. Now, a report on this from one other radio ham, whom I know quite well. This man's name is Robert Oxzaner. W9AUT is his car letters. He lives right now in Chicago, Illinois. And he lived with Mr. Smith and his family for approximately a month while he was on stay in Canada for one time. And during this time, he helped him with some of these experiments and actually saw it in operation. According to Bob Oxzaner, they hooked the tensor energy coil up to this Collins transmitter, and they suddenly dislodged this coil from the transmitter, and there was a pop, a crack as they dislodged it, and angel hair precipitated out all over the floor of the laboratory in which they were doing this operation. So this, of course, very interesting, brings up a possibility. Number one, is angel hair actually a result of this warp, perhaps we are producing, whatever it might be, the actual conversion of electromagnetic energy, a field of electromagnetic energy, into a field of tensor energy? Or, as some people would say, and the possibility, of course, is equally great, is angel hair actually ionized hair? Here we have a sudden snap, you see, an electromagnetic field, an electrical discharge with its high power. So possibly, you see, we have air naturally around it. We have an electrical discharge. Everything, you see, perfect, conducive for the formation of something as a result of ionization of the surrounding air. The next theory, of which Mr. Smith holds the authorship, is that of reduced binding force. Now, as you probably know, binding force can best be described as that nuclear force which holds molecules together in their binding. It holds atoms together to form molecules. It holds solids to remain solid, liquid to remain liquid, gas to remain gas. It's the force that keeps the molecules from dispersing. It actually holds them together. This we refer to as binding force. According to Mr. Smith, there are wandering about the Earth areas, which he calls vortices, in which there have been reductions in the binding force. He calls these, very appropriately, reduced binding force vortices. Now, these vortices are actually formed by the detonation of nuclear devices. Mr. Smith contends that every time there is a detonation of a nuclear device at the area of detonation and the gravitational antipode, that is the point approximately on the other side of the Earth in which we have the opposite from this point of gravity, the opposite counterpart at the other side of the Earth, at these two points we have an area produced of reduced binding. Now you might say, well, how big are they? And of course, you're going to ask, what do they do? Well, let me answer the first question, which I asked first. The
binding force vortex itself is approximately 1,000 feet or perhaps even a mile in diameter. They vary greatly. And, of course, both of them, regardless whether it be on the point or at the point in which we have the detonation or at the gravitational antipode on the other side of the Earth. This is still about 1,000 feet to a mile in diameter are these vortices. What do they do was the next question I suggested to be asked, and the answer to this is that they do reduce the structural tensile strengths of materials. For example, in Canada, there was a bridge collapse. Some of Mr. Smith's associates with devices which would detect that, which we shall discuss in a moment, went to this area, and these devices definitely, most decidedly and positively, registered reduced binding area. They had a crash of an airplane, a large commercial plane, right at takeoff from an airfield, and of course at takeoff we have maximum stress. We have the fuselage still trying to set down on Earth. We have the wings with the course lift being pulled up, and at this point we have the maximum stress on the fuselage against the wings, and this plane did fold and crash. Immediately then, Mr. Smith and some of his associates, or just the associates, again, this is irrelevant, went into the area with the binding force detectors and very positively, again, did find that there was reduced binding. Now, how do we make one of these detectors to find out whether there is such a thing? It is worthwhile, I believe, to make such a detector. For example, a practical application of this: steel samples were tested in Ottawa at the National Research Council at 90,000 pounds per square inch of tensile strength. These same steel samples were shipped to Washington Bureau of Standards. At the Washington Bureau of Standards, they were 5,000 pounds per square inch. There was definitely a difference here, you see, between the binding forces at the two locations. So this has a practical as well as an interesting theoretical possibility. We could have one of these as a monitor. We can have it going. If one of these should go by, you see, and perhaps we are doing something demanding maximum stress on machinery or something like this, why, of course, we can immediately see whether we're in an area of reduced binding force. Again, might I say, of course, that I'm trying to represent as fairly as possible Mr. Smith's theories as to this. A very convenient device for measuring reduced binding would be anything which is put under a tremendous amount of tensile strength right up to its normal breaking point and just before this point at which it's about to warp out of shape, and we'll put an indicator needle, for example, and mark on a background that this is where this needle is and is normally being pulled. For example, if we had a spring that would stretch out of shape at, say, 20 pounds, we'll pull it to 19 pounds, put an indicator needle at the point at which it's having its maximum deflection, and put a mark, a little graphic mark right behind it as to where it has been pulled. Now, if we went into an area of reduced binding, you see, and this thing were to stretch because of this, not being able to withstand the pull under which it had been subjected, why, of course, we would see that it would deflect from that little point that we had marked on the escutcheon behind it. Now, a good device we can actually build to duplicate this means of detection of reduced binding force, as well as this nylon monofilament fishing line which I have here. One has a 2-pound test, and the other is a much greater pull. I think it's somewhere around 8 or 10 pounds test. Now, if we take these two, and we take maybe just a couple inches or so of each, maybe 6 inches of each, and tie a common end together from each of them, and pull, obviously, we can get to a certain point at which one will stretch out of shape, perhaps even break. The other one will still be well within its tolerance. The reason, of course, we use the both lines as being made of the same material, nylon, is that they will be self-compensating in terms of humidity variation and in terms of temperature variation. I saw a device which was constructed by one of the members of the Ottawa UFO group. This man is an instrument maker, and he constructed a device that was beautifully balanced. It consisted of a knife blade edge which was being pulled from both sides. In other words, it was in a notch, the blade was in a notch, and both sides were being pulled down by a nylon strand. One was the thin nylon, one was the heavier nylon on the other side, and these were then pulled down very, very tightly. And he had a long indicator needle on here, which was against a scored escutcheon, which of course was set at zero. And as this would pull one way or another, there would be, of course, the slightest amount of change in binding force. This needle would show a very great deviation, a great deflection.
Now, of course, as you know, I am extremely interested in UFOs, else I wouldn't belong to NICAP, and more recently APRO, and of course having been first chairman of the Cleveland Ufology Project. But I presume that in your talks with him, you did discuss the UFO picture, because he does know a great deal about UFOs, isn't that correct, Bob?
Most decidedly. There's no doubt about that at all, Earl. Wilbur Smith was, of course, the director, chairman, however you want to refer to it, of the Project Magnet, also called Canada's Flying Saucer Lookout Lab, which was under the auspices of the Canadian Department of Transportation, their equivalent more or less to our Federal Communications Commission, also our Transportation Regulations Governing Agency. This was a little laboratory which was constructed up in Shirley Bay, Ontario, near Ottawa, near Mr. Smith's home, actually within just a few minutes of automobile transportation time. They had in this little building a large number of small pieces of electronic equipment and so on. They had a device, for example, for detecting any changes in radiation. They had devices for magnetic changes, devices for gravitational flux, various geophysical devices like this. And at one instant, I've been assured, this definitely did operate. We had, for example, Bob Oxzaner, a friend of Wilbur Smith, a fairly close friend, and one who has seen a large number of Wilbur Smith's efforts in the UFO field, knew of an instance in which all of the devices sounded at once. Not only did they all sound the alarm at once, but also they went off human, I guess, just about the treatment he received from constantly being badgered. So for this reason, they went underground with it. Much of this is still going on, however, at the time, because of Mr. Smith's illness, of course, he has been unable to guide the efforts. During the actual operation, however, of this, when Mr. Smith was on his feet, he was constantly visited by both Canadian government officials as well as American government officials. These were, of course, upper echelon people with attaché cases that were chained and locked to their wrists to make sure, of course, that none of the information was dropped or left behind in a station, a bus station or something. And so he had a number of these visits. They had samples they wanted him to analyze of hardware, that is actually metal that had been found. They often made many statements. I might mention some of the statements that had been made concerning, do we have hardware? Does the American government possess hardware? According to Mr. Smith, let me cite this. In 1954, we, of course, had a, shall we say, either a noteworthy or a notorious sighting over Washington, D.C. During this time, an Air Force jet shot a piece right off an unidentified flying object. It was a piece of an egg. It was found 2 hours later, and it had a glow to it. Actually, it was glowing. It was a silvery white glow to it. This white, after about 2 weeks, had diminished to a brown texture. The object itself that was shot off, the chunk, was about as big as could be held in a couple of hands grasping it. It was had a very distinct chunk of edge. It was curved. It had tapering sides so that it looked like it had actually been shot or a chunk broken off from the edge of a double saucer shape, the typical shape.
Bob, I'd like to just break in here for a second. I recall a year ago when Reverend Bauer from Massachusetts spoke to our group, Cleveland Ufology Project, out of the Danish Smorgasbord at our annual dinner, that he was referring to a piece of metal. This was the first time I had heard it mentioned, having been shot down from one of these.
UFOs over Washington back in 52, and he said that Admiral Knowles held this piece in his hand. Does this tally, Bob, with what Wilbur Smith had told you?
Most decidedly, this would be probably about the right size. I mentioned Wilbur Smith showed with his hands holding something with two hands as he was describing it visually as best he could without the sample and specimen. And the only thing which, of course, did not jive, as would be obvious on this, is the two dates. I said 54. You discussed the very famous sighting of 52, and I feel quite likely this chunk was probably the famous 52 sighting, which I simply have in my notes as the wrong date.
Well, you know, back in November of last year, when Bill Gordon asked me to be on his program one night on radio, WERE, I brought this point out, hoping that maybe there would be some comment from the radio audience. This, to the best of my knowledge, was the first and only time the sighting of 52 relative to the piece being shot down and being held by Admiral Knowles has ever been made public.
Yes, and some more of the information about this. It's a shame that no one had commented on it as a result of the program. Perhaps Mr. Smith would have had he been able to hear it in Ottawa. However, I have a little bit late, perhaps, but something we can edit in here. Some of the factual material concerning that chunk. First of all, it had a, we're getting back to radio again, an initial resonance. That is, when it was found, this unidentified chunk of material actually had a radio frequency resonance of 4.5 megacycles. That is, it actually had a sensitivity to 4.5 megacycles. This was when it was, however, initially found. After a while, it had lost. After that 2 weeks, when it had gone down to its dull brown color, it had lost its initial 4.5 megacycle radio resonance and had also lost an initial high magnetic permeability. It was very, very magnetic when it was first found. The material itself was magnesium orthosilicate. This was the matrix of the material, magnesium orthosilicate. And upon microscopic examination, it was found to contain thousands of little tiny spheres that were embedded all through the matrix, and these little spheres, we don't know why they're there, but they were in the construction, were approximately 15 microns in diameter, and they were dimpled. Each one had a slight dimple in one side of it. According to Mr. Smith, the United States military intelligence has tons of hardware. They had readily admitted to this upon interview by Mr. Smith during the time he was director of this research project in Canada, and they have much film. Of course, we know of many cases which have been told to us in which film was never returned. Cape Canaveral skin divers, this is also an interesting one. While trying to recover during a scavenging salvage operation for rocket materials over the edge of Cape Canaveral, recovered a device which was round, around 10 inches or 15 inches in diameter, like about the size of a basketball, and very much effort was expended in trying to cut a chunk out, but once they did cut out a piece, it was found to contain, as a one-issue newspaper that had gotten hold of it related, a tape recording mechanism of advanced design and many unknown parts. Concerning the actual structure of UFO metal, Mr. Smith offers this. That metal, when recently analyzed, or I should say when analyzed, and the metal itself as a specimen is a very recent vintage, will be subject to what he calls time dilation. And that if we take a spectrographic analysis, the entire spectrograph will be shifted to the right or to the left, showing that actually time, as this exposure is being made, there's a time constant which is being warped here and is actually changing. And for example, then if we look at this metal in a spectrograph, we put a known sample there, and we take this metal, which might even have some of that same metal in it. When the lines from the spectrograph line up, there will actually be a shift of the entire spectrograph, or I should say the spectrogram itself, over to either the right or the left as we analyze it. This is the result of a time dilation. This will normalize, however, after a few months following an exponential curve of dissipation. Actually, it's a sort of a trigonometric function. This will dissipate and gradually go back to normal again, following an exponential curve. Mr. Smith found that some of it was violently exothermic. That is a tremendous release of energy upon being stimulated to release its energy. He had a size maybe half the size of a pea, and he wanted to make this a little bit smaller and make it a bead shape, and so he took an oxyacetylene torch to try to cut it down, and on putting it, it showered sparks for about 20 seconds, mushrooming up in a big mushroom burst, actually, of sparks. After the ignition by this oxyacetylene torch to try and burn it down a little bit. Now, that metal which he used is this sample that I hold here right in my hand now. And if you look at it, it looks like
a dirt, 2 inches?
About 2 inches square or so.
Very
and it looks like a very rough pouring and cooling.
Thin at one point.
Yes, that's right.
Thick at the other.
It's almost like a part of a splatter, really, of it. And it's getting rusty now. However, if you look at the freshly broken inside, you can see that it is very crystalline and cast in appearance.
Yes, it has a...
This was given a spectrographic analysis, and I got no report. Yes, it is extremely heavy. I got no report of it being exothermic, and it was a piece of this that was exothermic for Mr. Smith. The result of the spectrogram when analyzed, this is very high in both iron, of course, as you would expect from its appearance and its feel, and also very high in manganese, both of which, of course, are prevalent in good steels. So this apparently then has a high manganese and a high iron content. I'm asking now, this was only analyzed a few days ago at Union Carbide, and I'm hoping for a piece of it, or rather for the analysis, the spectrogram itself, to be submitted to me for my record.
These high spots, I notice, are shiny. Have they been filed?
They have been roughed, yes, in order to get ideas of texture of the metal itself.
Whereas the edges broken are very crystalline.
Right, and those were hit off by a sledgehammer.
That what is the golden color due to?
That is rust. That's rust? Actually just rust.
Is that so?
Mm-hmm. Now, the history of this metal is rather interesting. I find it quite interesting, as a matter of fact. This was actually found on the north shore of the St. Lawrence River near the village Écuyer, which is 20 miles west of Quebec City. It was found in July 1960. According to the townspeople, it was not on the shore before July 1st. It was found around July 4th, very close to the 4th of July.
How large a piece was this?
Originally, there were two large pieces, the total weight being a couple of tons. Couple of tons, yes. Now, how it would get in, some people suggested it came in from an ice flow, but of course, this is a little bit absurd that a piece could come in weighing a couple tons on a chunk of ice. But in any case, there were two of these chunks closely associated, and they were both on the north bank of the St. Lawrence River, outside of Écuyer, near Quebec City. And the larger one, unfortunately, before Mr. Smith's crew could get hold of it, had been already salvaged by a salvage company and was shipped, was on its way being shipped over to Japan to be melted down for our transistor radios or something.
About how large would you say these pieces were that weighed that much?
I couldn't guess except to say that it would be probably in the neighborhood of several feet in diameter, probably 3 or 4 feet in diameter. A cubic? No, more like a square yard, an inch or two in depth.
Oh, is that so?
This would be my guess.
It was not a thick piece.
No, not particularly thick. They were heavy enough, however, that in order for Smith to get a chunk out, they had to actually get a tank wrecker, which, of course, would be a device for trying to salvage tanks which had gone over in ditches and so on. So this gives you an idea of approximately how big the device itself was, or I should say the chunk of raw material. As to why it was there, how it got there, we don't know. We can only surmise that, who knows, it might have been poured there, it might have been dropped cool. This would only be conjecture on my part. There are some other ideas. I got into the discussion of fireballs with him. What are these fireballs? Are they meteors or what? apparently, according to Mr. Smith, his theory on these, with perhaps evidence and research which he has put into it, the green exploding fireballs that have been seen are primarily copper. And copper because copper has a neutron capture ability. It's capable of capturing neutrons. And for this reason, it is actually of, shall we say, intelligent design and of intelligent origin and is in the atmosphere capturing radioactive neutrons. And these are the, when they get to a certain amount of radioactive intensity with the neutron absorption, they do simply explode and dissipate. In, of course, East Haven, Connecticut, there's a billboard which was hit. This was hit by a monitor, and the monitor itself was 16 inches in diameter, and there was an actual atomic transmutation that took place here. As you remember, they found bits of copper around this billboard. According to Mr. Smith, the cause of this was that the galvanized zinc of the billboard itself was transmuted into copper by the impact of nuclear radiation during this the meeting of the two metals.
When did you say, or did you see when this took place?
I have no date on this. This was in the publication on flying saucers by the young Max Miller.
I see.
Also, this was a paper bound, as you might remember.
Yes, I do.
There was a good diagram, by the way, of a Cartwright detector, which we shall get into in a moment, and I'll describe. The fireballs themselves are generally around 100 feet in diameter, and the copper of which the fireballs are composed are of a rare isotope. It's a rare isotope with good neutron capturing ability. For actually detecting UFOs, being able to have some device which will say to you, there's a UFO here in the area, why Mr. Smith suggests the standard Cartwright detector. And, of course, we all know this is basically a compass needle which normally points north and south and to which has been connected some device which will either electrically complete a circuit when the needle moves or possibly a mirror that will reflect a beam of light or something like this that will indicate. Now, I have here a device which is basically a long iron needle, as you can see, about as big as an old-fashioned, real heavy pencil graphite.
And it's about 8 inches long?
Yeah, it's about 8 inches long, and it is suspended by a strip of brass, and the brass is a hanger that suspends itself on a little point, as you can see, this little pivot.
Now, it will curve.
Right, and the brass is curved so that we can force the magnetic iron little rod through it, of course, both ends, so that it can be hung over this little pin, this little pivot. Now, originally I tried to hook this up so that it would make a contact electrically, but it was very unstable. It would jiggle an awful lot. So I have devised another means of actually utilizing this another way. Mounted on here will be very shortly, I'm finishing this now, a little piece of paper or anything that will obstruct light. Now here is a device that is actually a transistor audio oscillator feeding into a little speaker, and on it is a photoelectric cell. As I pick this up, notice when the sunlight hits it, we get a rather cow-sounding noise.
I presume this rod is now pointing directly north. That's right.
Just as though, although you have a magnetic personality, actually it's pointing towards the Earth's magnetic north. And, of course, it will maintain this position. Now, what I do, I shine a beam of light across this piece of whatever it is that's obstructing light on this little compass needle, more or less, and as long as that is in between this photoelectric cell that's hooked up on this audio oscillator, the beam of light will never strike the cell and will never get a tone. But as soon as this thing moves, the light will go by that little obstruction and...
Yeah.
We get the noise. Also, there's a device here that I throw the switch, and now it says light.
Oh,
now notice,
light there, yeah.
Right, as I take, again, let light get by here, a little bulb goes on.
A little bulb is on.
And although then again it would return to its normal position, and be obstructed, the bulb remains on.
So in other words, this is showing, if you're away from it, that something has occurred
right
during your absence?
That's it exactly.
Wonderful.
So you see, you have an idea here, an actual visible means of determining whether you've had an event, although even in your absence.
Well, this is nothing that is commercially obtainable. This is something you yourself produce out of various parts?
That's right. However, only to one degree. Now, this device that I use is actually a code oscillator. It's put out by the Heathkit Company, which is very famous for its kits, put out by, well, actually, it's a Daystrom subsidiary. And it's in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and they have this. It's called their CO1 code oscillator. It was used to practice Morse code. Now, of course, all I had to do was put this little photoelectric diode. It's a photosensitive diode. I just put it right across the terminals to which your Morse code key would be attached, and when light strikes it, the tone happens. Or when you put it in light position and let light strike it, the bulb will go on. Even though you cover up the diode again, the bulb will remain on. So you can use it in either one of those positions for your own detection. Concerning how much magnetism is required to deflect a Cartwright detector, according to Mr. Smith, of course, the Earth's magnetic field is less than 1 Gauss, which is a unit of magnetic flux density, and it's about 0.5 Gauss unit. The flux originating from a UFO is 500,000 Gauss of flux, meaning, of course, you have a tremendous magnetic field set up, and for this reason, a device like this would become extremely applicable for the detection of the presence of some of these aerial phenomena. All this, of course, could lead us to certain conclusions. I think that probably everyone who hears this tape or who has ever investigated UFOs perhaps has his own pet theories as to their origin, whether or not they do exist. Let me only say one thing to be put on record, that I believe there's an overwhelming amount of evidence, of factual information, of hardware, of material, which shows that there is something. What it is, again, this could be conjecture. However, of course, many of us have opinions which greatly do coincide. As to my opinion, this, of course, would come to me by my own, I hope, intelligent reasoning. And I feel that all of this data, all of this hardware, all of these films, all of this material does show that there is a little bit more to it than perhaps many sources would have us believe. That if we were to amass and evaluate all of the information available, we would have a tremendous reservoir of information concerning the positive existence of certain types of aerial phenomena.
Well, I appreciate very much, Bob, the time you've given to telling us, giving us all this information that you received through Robert Smith in Canada. I feel that Cleveland Ufology Project will be happy to hear it played at the forthcoming meeting. I hope you will be there in person and be able to speak, but this may be used to refresh your memory at points. But it's much nicer, of course, to listen to you live rather than on tape.
Thank you.